Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, recording today from the beautiful Hollywood, California. And I want to say thank you to La Fuente Hollywood Treatment Center for giving us a space to record. We appreciate that. You might hear some traffic noise in the background. We are in the heart of Hollywood, so there's nothing we can do about the traffic. Today's guest, I'm so excited for you guys to hear a little bit of this story. It's so good. Freddie Negrete is joining us. Freddie's book is Smile Now, Cry Later, Guns, Gangs, and Tattoos, My Life in Black and Gray. So Freddie, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Well, you got the tattoo artist part right, but I'm actually best known for pioneering the style of tattoo called Black and Gray Realism. It has its roots in the Chicano, Cholo, Barrio scene of East LA in the 70s. That was my life. I was like a Chicano gang member. And we gave the world khakis and Pendletons and bandanas, graffiti, and tattoos.
And tattoos. There
yeah.
You go.
So, and, you know, I was born with art abilities. So, and as a young Chicano, we had certain images that were really important to us, like the clown girl. And the chara girl, the sombrero, and the gun belt, Aztec imagery, religious Catholic images, you know, crosses, roses, Jesus, Mary, things like that. Mm-hmm. And writing, because we were very big on who we were and where we were from. And then spending most of my life in institutions, I developed my own style of art. And then in prison, learn how to tattoo with the homemade tattoo machine in there. And when I got out, I started tattooing out of my apartment. Meanwhile, a tattoo shop opened up in East LA and found that everybody wanted tattoos, but they wanted their tattoos to look like they were done in prison. They wanted the Chicano style.
Right. So you actually learned to tattoo in prison?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the, like, how do you tattoo? What is a tattoo gun like in prison?
It's funny because, you know, the machine that they use most today is a rotary machine, and it's based off of that prison design. And basically, it's a motor that you break out of a CD player, or back then it was a cassette player.
Right.
And you use a toothbrush, a big pen, a sharpened guitar string, tape, and that motor, and a paperclip, and that's what you need to build a homemade tattoo machine. And they're
pretty efficient. Is it much more painful
than the regular?
Than regular.
It all hurts, you know.
You're
poking the skin, so it all kind of hurts.
I feel like when I got my tattoo, it was almost more kind of annoying than painful. And I thought it was going to be really painful because it's right on my spine between my shoulders. And I thought kind of being on the bone, like I thought it was going to be really bad, but it wasn't. It didn't hurt that bad, but it did after a period of time. I was like, all right, can we get through this now? You know, like it just started to be annoying.
Right. Yeah. I mean, tattoos aren't that painful because so many people wouldn't get them if it was.
Right, right.
But
people do say different areas are more painful than other areas, I'm sure.
Right. And I think, was that your first tattoo?
Yes.
So your first tattoo is the least painful, you know, because everybody likes to scare you and they're telling you how painful
it
is.
You're so prepared.
Yeah. And you're expecting the worst. And then you realize, wow, it's not that bad. But it never gets easier after that.
Right.
Each tattoo after that hurts more and more and more.
I stopped at one, so.
Maybe you're not an addict.
Maybe tattoos are the only other addiction I can't get to stick. I can't get exercise to stick either. That's the other one I don't have. So in your journey, at what point did you realize that you had a problem with drugs and alcohol?
I guess I kind of always knew. As a youngster, you know, in the hood and all that. You know, we were all down on heroin and hard drugs like that because the older homeboys would do it, and it would seem to take them out of the loop. You know, all of a sudden they were in the cut and just sneaky and just concerned about their dope habit, whereas we were involved in this gang war, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And they would go so far as even fraternize with the enemy, you know,
right,
over drug deals and stuff like that. But we were mostly, you know, we drank, and there were barbiturates around. We smoked weed. So I never really felt like I had a drug problem until I became one of those older guys and started using heroin. So I was about 22 when I started. So I was kind of a late bloomer on that. And every time I would get addicted, because I had this process that I'd kind of go through, I knew it was a problem. And when it was taking control of my life, what we would do is go to the methadone clinic and get on methadone. And I would usually stay a year, I think the longest, maybe 2 years, doing the methadone maintenance program.
Right.
And then I detox, and then I would chip, you know, for a long time. I thought that I could just get high at picnics and weddings and stuff like that.
Right. Using drugs socially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I don't know why I'd be at the picnic just nodding out. Yeah. What happened?
Amazing.
Did I miss it?
Is it over?
but you know, eventually, then I would do it every weekend, and then once during the week, and before you know it, I'd be strung out again. So I was always aware that it was a problem and it was causing serious problems in my life. But back then, I don't remember there ever being a treatment center or rehab.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you went to treatment.
Yeah, I didn't even know about it. And I even when rehabs did become a thing, I would never do that.
Yeah.
I would never turn myself in somewhere, you know, because I was a jailbird. I was always locked up. I would never just willfully go.
Go, yeah, right, right. It's funny to me how many people think, too, a lot of people have that view of treatment like it's a lockdown facility, like you really can't leave. And like when I do interventions, it's always one of the things I say. I'm like, listen, remember, this is not lockdown. Like you're an adult. You can leave if you want to, you know,
right,
because people do have that sense of kind of being imprisoned when they go to treatment. I didn't go to treatment, but for me, it was because I thought treatment was what the celebrities did. I didn't think that.
Right.
I didn't think regular people went to treatment, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true also. You know, my first experience with a treatment center, when I got out of prison around 2005, I was on parole. Mm-hmm. And then I gave two dirty tests and my parole officer said, that's it. And he put me in his car and he took me to this place in the inner city. And it was really like just an inner city jail. It was barbed wire fence around it. We had to stay locked up in our rooms. It was a grueling experience. I ended up just running away from there, but I had to break out.
Wow.
You know,
how long were you there?
Not too long, just a few weeks.
But it was actually treatment, or it was supposed to be?
It was supposed to be, but it was supported by the parole office.
Right.
And the state of California. And to me, it just seemed like they set up this little inner city jail.
Right, right.
To where, you know, like, okay, instead of processing them into jail and violating them, we're just going to dump them off there.
Over here, yeah.
And say, okay, you got to stay in there for 5 months. And there was no way I was going to stay in there for 5 months.
Right.
You know, but if you leave, then you get a warrant and
it's a violation.
It's a violation.
Right.
Yeah. So luckily for me, I mean, I found a reason, you know, to run away, and then I used it on my parole officer. And then I tattoo all these sheriffs, and they called my parole officer and told him, give him another chance and stuff.
Yeah.
And so we did. By that time, I figured out how to use a Wizinator. You know,
oh,
so.
My gosh. The bane of my existence as an owner of sober living.
Right.
I always have to be aware of the Wizinator.
Yeah, and my parole officer was female, so it was really
right.
Easy. She wasn't going to watch me go, you know.
Yeah.
Directly,
yeah, in the same way. So my sober livings are, I have men's houses, and obviously I can't do their UAs, and our policy is very, very strict that someone stands there. So yeah, obviously I can't do it, but I have to go through the whole thing, you know, no baggy clothing, no hoodies or sweatshirts. Like there can't be any way to hide anything.
Right. You know, so one time, and this thing was like, it would be, you know, like this thing that straps around your waist. Right. And there was like this pouch and I had the fake pee in there. But I remember, so, and you bring out a little tube and you unclip it and fill the bottle. One time I didn't clip it back right. And then and I was wearing like faded Levi's. And my pants were all wet,
like you
and there's parole officers everywhere, and I was like, I got to get out of here, you know?
Oh, my gosh. I guess I should probably explain, too, for listeners that don't know, the Wizinator is an apparatus where you keep fake urine in there, and like Freddie said, it wraps around your waist. It has a little tube, so when you go in to do a UA, you use the little tube with the fake urine so that you have a negative urine test instead of a positive urine test.
We're not trying to put anybody up on game here.
Yeah, right. We don't want to give anybody any ideas.
Yeah.
I'm just saying don't do it. What it is. Don't do it. It's ridiculous. So for you, what was the hardest thing about getting sober and staying sober?
Well, again, I never ever really thought about stopping completely. Later on in life, you know, I found out about speed, and so I would mix heroin and speed together, you know. But I would always stop and on and off. What really brought me down was in 2004, my youngest son passed away, you know, and he was murdered in a gang incident, and he was kind of following my footsteps, so I felt a tremendous amount of guilt for that. And not only that, you know, I had a custody battle with his mother. And he was living with her in Grover Beach, the Central Coast, beautiful area. Mm-hmm. And I brought him here to Los Angeles to live with me because I won the custody battle. And he ended up getting murdered. And to tell the truth, I wasn't that great of a father when I brought him here. I kind of let him do his own thing. And so, you know, there was just a tremendous amount of guilt. And I just plunged into the worst drug addiction that I had ever been in. I just needed to be loaded at every minute because...
Right.
If not, I'd wake up in the morning thinking about my son, and I would just be crying, you know. I just couldn't take it. But as soon as I did that shot, I didn't care anymore.
Right.
You know, and so I had to stay like that. And I didn't want anybody to mention his name. I didn't want to see a picture of him. I didn't want to be reminded in any way. I just wanted to stay high. But also, at that same time, my years of drug addiction was taking its toll on my health. And so I was also diagnosed with drug-induced congestive heart failure. Congestive heart failure is usually something that a real big person mm-hmm. would get or you know, is associated with diabetes, you know what I mean? And so mine was drug-induced, you know. So at that time, my health was getting really bad. I wasn't taking any kind of medication that I was supposed to be taking. I was just using heroin and speed. And then eventually I got arrested, you know, for possession, and I went to prison. Luckily, when I went to prison, of course, they started giving me the medication for my heart and everything. But when I got out, I went right back to using right away.
So when you, like you mentioned that obviously with the death of your son, your addiction went to a new level, right?
Right.
Can you look back over the course of your addiction and kind of see, like I can look back from my very beginning now and I can see each point where I kind of kicked it up a notch. You know what I mean? Like I can see each point, I can see the progression, I guess is what I'm saying, where in the beginning, I always say I was kind of a late bloomer too. I didn't drink until a little bit later. I was like 20, 21 before I really started drinking. And I never did drugs. I'm just a good old-fashioned drunk. But in the beginning, it's like we would go out to do fun things, right? We'd go to bars. We would go out dancing, whatever. And we might have some drinks while we were doing it. And then there was another point a little bit later where we were going out to drink. Like that was the point of going out. Then there was another time a little bit later where I realized we didn't do anything that didn't revolve around drinking. Like I can just see each point of my progression where it kind of got worse. And then after that, after the place of we don't do anything that doesn't involve drinking, the next place was really like plunging into the deep end, really drinking with a vengeance when it got really dark and sad. And I only lasted there for about 3.5 years, and then I got sober. But when you look back on your journey, like, can you see those points in your addiction?
Yes, I can. Like I was saying, where I would try to get high just on certain occasions. And then, you know, I would do it more and more frequently until I was strung out. With that last run that I had, the day the incident happened, you know, because I was just doing speed at the time, and I hadn't done heroin in years. I did heroin the day of, and just didn't stop. And it really got bad. You know, I had this friend from Seattle. He was a pretty wealthy guy, you know. He owned a construction company, and he built businesses, you know, and he sold them and stuff. So he was going, dude, I'm gonna come to L.A., and I'm gonna help you build a business. I'm gonna help you rebuild your life, you know, because of this. You know, he knew my son really well. You know, we were friends for years, and I'm gonna help you through this, you know. But really, when he came down, he was having his own escape.
Right.
He was trying to get away from his wife and his life in Seattle. So he came and rented an apartment where I lived. And together, him and I just became like these hopeless dope fiends. I don't know if you ever saw that movie of those two twin doctors. It's a drug movie. But it's these two doctors that one of them keeps using drugs, and finally the other one succumbs. And so all day long, they're like, okay, it's 3 o'clock. We're time for this dose.
Right.
And they're mixing all these drugs and everything. Right. And I kind of felt like that, you know, like we had everything, oxys, speed, eventually a lot of heroin. We weren't broke. We had the money. So anyways, though, I really felt it affecting my health.
Yeah.
And then actually, he went back to Seattle. That's when I went to prison, when I got arrested. Then when I got out of prison, I started using again. That's when my health got really bad, because they were giving me the medication I needed for my heart.
While you were in there.
Yeah, while I was in there. But I had to be on that medication for the rest of my life. You know,
right.
It's just like the blockers and then, you know, the high blood pressure. But my heart was really enlarged, and I had a lot of trouble getting oxygen.
So could you actually feel it physically, like when you stopped taking the medication, like you would feel different?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because I couldn't, you know, walk a half a block without gasping for air. And my heart would always just be racing, you know, because I was mixing speed and heroin together.
Your poor little heart was doing a lot of work.
Yes.
I
overworked the poor guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the second time when I had that run going, I mean, my health got really bad. I couldn't take more than a few steps, and I couldn't take any deep breaths. Like, my breaths were like,
yeah.
That's how I had to breathe in order to get enough oxygen to not pass out.
Wow.
You know, and then when I went to the county jail, I got arrested again. Now I was on parole with a new beef. And so when I went to the county jail, the withdrawals, the medical condition, you know, together just proved to be a near fatal experience for me.
Yeah, I bet.
You know?
Miserable.
Yeah. And I, you know, I ended up having 3 heart attacks when I was in there. And I was certain that I was going to
die. Like close together?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And not feeling much better. So each time I would go into cardiac arrest, they would take me to the hospital, to the jail hospital. And, you know, and they'd add more medication. I was taking like 13 different pills. And then they send me back to the jail in a wheelchair. And luckily, you know, like I said, I tattoo all these sheriffs. And so they knew me. They would take me out of the hospital, put me in a special dorm, bring me food from the streets.
Right.
You know, they took good care of me. In fact, I remember some of them after the whole ordeal and I was tattooing, they're like, we're the ones that nursed Negrete back to health. <You know? laughs> But I was certain that I was going to die in there.
Yeah.
And the jail doctor is saying, I just don't see how you can go on without a heart transplant. You know, so thanks. Very encouraging words there, you know. I don't think they're going to give a heart transplant to a parolee who's going on his way back to prison. But anyways, you know, I have some religious background, and I remembered a story about a prophet that went to a king and told him, get your affairs in order. Your time is up. You're going to die. And so that king went over the prophet's head and went to God himself and asked for more time, and God gave him 15 more years, you know. And I remember the thing about the story was he didn't ask for any reason. He just asked for more time. And, you know, we always pray, you know, when we're down on our luck, right, and different things. But this time I felt different. I was like, I was going to talk to God. And in order to get to some of the shower room where I could be alone, because I was in a dorm, I had to go up these two flights of stairs, you know. And
right,
I climbed up there, and took me about an hour, you know, because I couldn't breathe. And in my condition at that time, I couldn't even lay down. I couldn't lay back because I couldn't breathe. I couldn't take more than a few steps. I had to be in that wheelchair. It was like really bad. I was all skinny, discolored, you know. But anyways, I asked God for more time. I said, God, you know, I'm not going to make any promises because every promise I ever made, I broke. All I'm asking is for more time so that I can redeem myself and be an example to my son who's still living. You know, at that moment, I felt that I was never going to use again in my life.
You know, did.
I did feel like that. And that's kind of the only thing I felt. The next morning, I had a heart attack. And so when they're rushing me to the hospital, I should have been feeling like, well, my request was denied.
Right, right.
You know, but I didn't. That whole time I was in there, I was certain I was going to die. And now I was certain that I was going to live. I even told the ambulance driver, because, you know, that was the third time he took me to the hospital, because the jail has their own drivers.
Right.
And I said, he's going, you have a legitimate reason, because a lot of people fake injuries.
Yeah,
so they can go to the hospital and eat the food and lay in bed, you know. But he's telling me, you know, that I have a legitimate reason. And I was going, dude, you've always been cool with me. As he's trying to IV me, you know, trying to find a vein. I go, when I get out, go to Shamrock Tattoo, I'm going to give you a free tattoo.
Nice.
He goes, I'll be there, you know. I just believe, and I believe that at that moment, God gave me a gift of faith, you know, because they say it's impossible to please God without faith, but it's impossible to me to have the faith that God would cure me. You know
right.
what I mean?
Sure.
And I feel like it came to me as a gift, and I made a miraculous recovery, and then I didn't have to go back to prison. Then each day I felt better and better and better.
Yeah.
And they sent me back to the jail. All of a sudden I could lay down and sleep, you know. I started painting murals, because I paint murals whenever I'm in the county jail. I paint murals for them. And the captain wanted a certain mural painted, so I painted it for him. So all the while, my health was getting better.
Yeah, you're getting stronger.
Stronger, and I was painting that mural. So my lawyer was telling me, dude, you just have to take the 2 years. Because you were on parole. They caught you red-handed.
Right.
They have the right to search you. They searched you. They found drugs in your pocket. Why are you trying to fight this, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to go to prison. I want to go to a rehab, you know? I think that would help me, you know? And I remember when I got the last extension, he goes, oh, look, I'll extend it for 2 more weeks. But you think about it. If you don't take the 2 years that they're offering, they're going to give you 4, mm-hmm. you know? So, and I told him, what if I have a letter from a captain? He goes, they don't do that. They refuse to write letters for inmates, you know? It's a conflict of interest. So anyways, I told the sergeant, do you think I could talk to the captain? And she tells me, well, he got promoted to commander of all the jails, you know? And I was like, oh. She goes, but his office is still here, you know? What do you want to ask him? I'll tell him. I'll go, I want to see if you'll write a letter of recommendation. I don't think going to prison is going to help me. But I think a recommendation letter would help me for the judge to decide for me to go to a rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you know, he's not going to do that, but I'll tell him. So when I went to court, my lawyer said, wow. She goes, I don't know. The judge went in that pile of files, pulled yours out and said, this guy's going to rehab. So now,
did you get the letter?
No letter.
No letter.
Must have been a phone call.
Must have been a something.
Yeah. I'm sure it was a phone call or something, because they don't write letters.
Right.
You know, but he's the commander of all the jails.
Right.
I'm sure he has a direct line to the judge, you know. But for the judge to single my file out.
Right.
Like that. When I was about to, you know, accept the 2 years.
It's interesting, though. I feel like addicted people, we really do kind of have nine lives. You know, like there's so many of us, when you hear our stories, so many of us had those experiences where we really should have
died.
Yeah. Yeah. And usually some of us have, you know, on more than one occasion, we have those situations. Right. But we do kind of have nine lives. And we do, I don't know, I feel like when things line up, they line up really right for us.
Well, me, it just increased my faith. I'm certain that God healed my body and gave me more time.
Right.
And it's been 11 years now. You know, I'm on my 11th year. And my health is pretty good. I still have high blood pressure and I take pills for that. But it's just been a whole new experience for me. Like these last 10 years have been the best and the most meaningful 10 years of my whole life.
Yeah.
And I've accomplished a great many things. I helped produce the movie Tattoo Nation, which has become like the historical document for tattoo artists. I wrote my book. My coloring book just dropped. I've improved my work. You know, like I have a new focus on the work that I'm doing.
What made you decide to actually want to write a book? And then what gave you kind of the motivation to do it?
Well, you know, I had thought about it. I was thinking about it. But it was, you know, meeting my co-author, Steve Jones, who's a playwright. He's from England. And he happened to be here working on a different project. And he was working on this girl's grandmother's project. And when the girl found out that he was in recovery also, she goes, "Oh, do you want to come and hear my friend speak tonight at CGA meeting?" So CGA is Criminal and Gangsters Anonymous.
Okay.
So it's pretty good. They got a good thing going. And so anyway, she brought him and he heard my story. And then we all went for coffee after, you know. And when he told me he was a writer and the project he was working on, I was like, you know what? I really want to write a book, you know, and I just don't know how to go about it. He goes, "Well, maybe I can help you, you know, with some insight on what you would need to do to go forward if you were going to do that." And I told him, "I'm not much of a writer. I don't think I would be capable of penning the book actually myself, you know." And he said, "Well, you know, he had never done anything like that, and he was just a playwright." But anyways, so he had to drive to San Francisco the next day, and he says that on his way, his drive up, that something just came upon him like a ton of bricks. And he made the decision right there that he was going to help me write this book. And he called me the next day and said, "You know what? I'm going to help you write this." And so it was 6 years in the making. And, you know, and he lives in Austria, but thanks to technology and Skype.
Sure.
You know, for over 2 years, we just interviewed over Skype every night. And he did all the research and on how to go about writing a book, getting an agent, writing a proposal. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, and we had to cross so many hurdles, you know, like at first we couldn't find an agent that wanted to carry our thing. And then when we did, we got CEO of an agency, you know, like the top person.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't find, you know, a publisher, a major publisher, you know. It got to the point where we were going to, you know, just kind of publish it ourselves on a small scale. And we did get an offer. I remember our agent was like, "I got you guys a great offer with Powerhouse Books." They wanted to do this book, but they wanted it to be a big coffee table book with pictures of my work and just some text. And we're like, "No, we want to tell this story." Anyways, eventually.
You should do the coffee table book next.
Yeah, maybe I will.
Because I get where they're coming from too. Like if your work is beautiful, people love that. Like that would be a beautiful coffee table book, you know, with all that imagery.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Yeah.
And I probably will do that. And I'm collecting high def, you know, pictures of my work right now. And so Seven Stories is our publisher. They asked me to do a coloring book, an adult coloring book.
Yeah, you said that. That sounds amazing.
So that was good. And I'm putting material together to do a second book. And I think I will do a coffee table book.
Yeah.
Just a whole new experience for me, you know.
Yeah. And I love that too, because it's not an easy process, certainly to stay engaged in it and continue to do it. You know, like writing a book it takes some time. And I, just like you said, you had to overcome so many hurdles, you know, and I feel like that's the part that is kind of, that's so discouraging for people, where people will stop or will give up. So I think it's one of the greatest accomplishments when people actually do it, finish it, get it published, because I know it has to be somewhat grueling too.
It was. And like you said, it was a lot of work and a lot of heartache, but I always had faith and hope. I always believed that we could make it happen. And I always had hope that it would happen, you know.
Yeah. And all the best things that we do in our lives, I think, are always the hardest work.
Right.
You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, but I think too, because if it's easy, I won't appreciate it as much.
Right.
You know, it's like when you really have to work hard and you have to stick to it and have that grit and that perseverance, that's what makes the reward that much bigger.
Right. Yeah. Just seeing the book. Because they give you 10 copies.
Yeah.
But having it arrive in the mail.
What a great sense of accomplishment.
Yeah. And are seeing it in the bookstore.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So.
Yeah, that's amazing. I've always said, I hope in my next life, I hope I can draw. It's just something I've always wanted to be able to do. I think it's such a beautiful thing. And I'm an introvert, so I always imagine that if I could draw, like, it's all I would do. Like, I would never leave my house. You know, I would just draw nonstop. I love it.
Oh, maybe you should. I mean,
nobody wants that to happen, I promise you.
Well, I mean, art is an expression. I mean, you know what I mean?
I might be able to put that together.
We're looking at some modern art. You know, I knew this artist. It's a very successful artist. His last name was Robertson. But I was working at this a silk screening place, and this is in Palm Springs, and he had a studio, you know, like next to us, and it was out in the desert, but he set up these giant canvases under like a shaded, you know, canopy thing, and he'd throw paint on the canvas. I would go watch him. He was really cool. And he squirted it all over with a garden hose.
Oh, nice.
And it made all these beautiful blends. It was amazing. And then he'd come in with...
Now, see, I could probably do that.
Yeah, and then he had these brushes in his... Like, four brushes in each hand, different sizes, different colors. And he would just splash and splatter and... You know what I mean? And he made the most amazing things. But I knew it was art because of his intensity and his passion while he did it.
Right, right.
It was almost like he was doing this dance, shaking these brushes and hosing down the paint. You know,
like he
and
had
that's,
some intention
yes.
in what he was doing, yeah.
And he could knock out a couple of those a day, and he would get like $25,000 a painting.
Wow.
And sometimes more.
Yeah, sure.
But they were actually beautiful. You know, so you never know. I mean, you want to do art?
I should just start. I should start trying.
Yeah.
I always say I can't get good at something if I don't start.
Exactly.
Okay, final question. It's my favorite question. What is your favorite thing about being a sober person?
I guess that's an easy question to answer. It's reaching out to other people and helping them with their addiction.
Being of service.
Being of service, yes. And I have a lot of good opportunities being a tattoo artist. You know, when people get tattooed, it's hard to talk and get tattooed, but you can listen.
Yeah.
So I share a lot of stories, and I also work at a couple of rehabs. I work at Beit Teshuva. You know, I lead groups for young heroin addicts there. And then I do work at IOP, ARC, Authentic Recovery Center, also leading groups on spirituality.
Oh, cool.
You know, so because I do, there was a time in my life where I went to college and I was a religious studies, you know. So I have religious background, but I really... Being a part of the 12-step program and a non-biased spiritual approach has really put me in touch with my higher power and God. I mean, I did all that studying when I was in college and everything, but I can't really say that it got me any closer or any of a better understanding of a real spiritual being that wants to help me and loves me.
I always say in my life, I feel like I am divinely guided at all times. You know, and it is, Definitely not. I couldn't put a name or a label on whatever my spiritual practice is. It really is very personal, but I do feel like as long as I am really in tune with myself and with what's going on inside of me and around me, and I spend that time meditating, or for some it's praying, you know, whatever that practice is. But I feel like if I'm really in tune, then my path will always be presented to me. You know, I always know kind of what the next right thing to do is, and what feels right and what doesn't feel right, you know, and it just is, it's so comforting to kind of have that faith and not judging things like, is it good or bad or right or wrong? But if something doesn't work out, that doesn't make it bad. It just means that wasn't the right thing. So I got to pivot and figure out what the right thing is. You know, I just love having that kind of faith. I never had that before, certainly in my drinking life.
Right. I found that, yeah, it's not for me to judge what's right and what's wrong. Mm-hmm. What's beautiful about America is we're free. Mm-hmm. And so everyone makes their choices. And when political issues, you know, divide people from, I'm a believer and I'm a not right, believer, sure, because of this political issue, it's like, just forget about all that. Forget about everything you know and come meet God on a personal level, on a spiritual plane, just you and God. God will come and deal with you. And then just decide what's right for you.
Right.
You know, there's certain things that we know are wrong, like violence and stealing, you know, things like that. But certain issues, you know, like a person's free choice, that's what America's about.
Yeah.
It's about freedom. And I think that's what God wants in all of us. He doesn't want us to be forced to love him and to seek him and to serve him.
Or to judge one another for having different beliefs.
Right. He wants us to choose on our own free will. And not because of what somebody else says or what somebody is saying, this is wrong and you have to do it like this.
Yeah.
Forget about all that.
Yeah.
Just come, you know, meet God on your own terms. And it's unbiased spirituality.
Yes, you know? I love that. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. It's such a pleasure meeting you and getting to spend this time with you. Again, let me tell you, Freddie Negrete, his book is Smile Now, Cry Later, Guns, Gangs, and Tattoos, My Life in Black and Gray. It's by Freddie Negrete and Steve Jones. Thank you again, Freddie.
And you can get it on Amazon.
Get it on Amazon.
My website.
Which is?
Is FreddieNegrete.com.
Perfect.
And
it's Negrete, N-E-G-R-E-T-E.
Yes.
There we go.
And my Instagram is Freddie_Negrete if you want to see, you know, the work I'm doing. And if you actually want to get tattooed, then just call Shamrock Social Club in West Hollywood and schedule an appointment with Freddie.
Perfect. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast, candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.